Sometimes when it feels like the world is feeling especially fragmented or confusing, it can be hard to know how to act. It can be hard to even put words around it. Judy found her way through the thorny little thorny little moment about a new normal this morning with lots of grace. That's a good example, right? How do we talk about this? How do we think about this? How do we hold divergent experiences and opinions about this? How do we express them to one another in ways that are life building? So, for example, in terms of that disorientation and fragmentation, there are two very different dominant messages in the media landscape these days. One is a together message. We're in this together. We'll get through this together. Sometimes the more insistent we can only get through this together, when usually employed when we're trying to convince people that they should behave more uniformly for the sake of everyone. So that's sort of the together message. The other message that's often a part of the media landscape in North America these days is one of increasing polarization. A message that not only says that we're not in this together, but in fact that we're at one another's throats about every sort of thing you could pretty much imagine. Even when we don't want to be, we are impacted by the environment and by events around us. It's a little difficult to, rise above it all when there is behavior within the collective that can threaten the well-being of both ourselves and of those that we love. So living in the middle of conflicting messages like those and other kinds can be disorienting. It can even be distressing. And it's hard to resist just getting angry and letting people have it in ways that look and sound a lot like schoolyard bullying, name calling and put downs that have nothing to do with the issues at hand, character assassination, aggressive language, when we're in those kind of situations. And in some ways, if we choose to think about these issues at all, it's tempting to lay the blame at the feet of technology. The problem, people, is social media. I don't know why I chose that voice. Social media and its impact on us as human beings is, of course, a significant realm of consideration. More on that shortly. There are a whole bunch of reasons why it's easier for us to act and speak like fools when we aren't face to face with those we're in disagreement with. When we don't have to see them on the sidewalk, we don't have to do business with them, we don't have to watch our kids fall in love with their kids, we don't have to have our physical existence depend in some discernible way on some skill or resource they provide. With those kind of constraints, those kind of social constraints are removed, as they are when we're online, we can be deluded about something. We can start to believe that we live with so much relative autonomy that we actually don't need other people, with the possible exception of those we choose to, have in the bubble around us, whether that's a physical bubble or a technology-guided bubble. In fact, we can more easily act as though we not only don't need other people, but as though we can afford to alienate them in other ways and to degrees that make saying I'm sorry when we're wrong, and we will be wrong, that make saying I'm sorry when we're wrong feel like an exercise in too little too late. I suppose in many ways, all of that, at least for me, points toward questions like, how can we humanize our interactions in ways that might counteract some of those destructive forces? First of all, within ourselves, and also rippling outward into the world that we all share. This is something that needs to happen. Because we all know, I think, some version of that feeling of fear that we get in our gut when we consider the possible outcomes of someone that holds great power behaves as though the whole world should operate according to their preferences. We know that a world without humanizing checks and balances is a dangerous one, in ways that are similar to the dangers of us operating as individuals without having loving people around us to call us on our nonsense. Most of us, without some of those checks and balances in our lives, most of us would be runaway train in some direction or other. In relatively short order, under normal circumstances, by which I mean circumstances without extraordinary duress. Add the extraordinary duress, need for checks and balances goes up. I read an interesting interview recently with Ezra Klein about his relatively new book entitled Why We're Polarized. Klein is an American journalist, blogger, political commentator. He's the co-founder of Vox, also the editor-at-large for Vox. And the context for this particular interview was Wired, which is a monthly American print and online magazine that focuses on how emerging technologies affect culture, the economy, and politics. And so a lot of the conversation in that interview was about how the internet plays into these issues of polarization, as I expected it to be. But here's what I thought was especially interesting. Despite it being an easy target, Klein was unwilling to lay the blame for our growing polarization on the internet. He was clear in the interview about how he believes it contributes. But in the last part of the interview, he said something that struck me as very wise. He said that when we feel strongly about something, we are going to have polarizing opinions about it. And that polarization itself is not the problem. The problem, he said, is when we don't take our differing points of view into actual human settings. Interesting, eh? He said it this way. And bear in mind, this interview was published in February 2020. And so there's some specific political references here that need to be heard in that American pre-election context. So this is a quote. Take more of your politics offline and into your community. National politics is a shitty form of entertainment. It makes you feel bad. It's disempowering. If you want to be politically involved, get involved in making your community better. Vote with your ideals nationally, but spend your time working locally. If you're reading this in the Bay Area and you spend your time tweeting about how bad Trump is, hook up with organizations working to make housing more affordable and spend time doing that instead. Working with other people on real problems actually does cut polarization for a variety of reasons, but it's also just a more nourishing, empowering, enjoyable, an effective way to be involved. That last sentence, working with other people on real problems is a more nourishing, empowering, enjoyable, and effective way. In other words, it's a better way to live. It's better for us, and it opens into the possibility of doing something with our time and energy that might actually help other people rather than just sort of having us running back and forth between the wood pile and the fire, stoking the flames of alienation or polarization. 20th century mystic Thomas Merton once said that, quote, a little bit of God goes a long ways, close quote. And sometimes I just want to put that on a billboard and let it perk. That is a very interesting sentence. What does that mean? Well, for lots of us, it might point to religion because our experience of God is very bound up in our experience of religion in many cases. They go together to such a degree that we might not even think to separate them, although they are very separable. But if that's been our experience, if our ideas about God are bound up with our experiences and ideas about religion, we might think a statement like a little bit of God goes a long ways is one we should measure based on our experience with religion. So in that case, it might mean something to us like a little bit of God is plenty. Thanks very much. Let's just keep that within the bounds of Sunday morning. Doesn't really work that well anywhere else anyway, so a little bit of God goes a long ways. However, if we've ever encountered a transcendent life-changing power, and we've chosen to think of that or call that God, or even to include that in our ideas about God, then we might mean something very different by a statement like that. We might mean something more like what we mean when we try to describe getting swept down a whitewater rapid or caught in an avalanche or finding out that the mole we just got biopsied is cancerous, or trying to keep our mental health sorted out when a pandemic we can't stop goes on for a long time. A little bit of that goes a long ways. I think a statement like love your enemies comes with a similar complexity. It could mean a lot of different things. If we start with the assumption that love is a cuddly thing with soft fur and oversized eyes, which is, by the way, more or less the technical definition of cute. If we think about love as a kind of romanticized expression of only good feelings, then the idea of loving our enemies is utter nonsense. First of all, that's pretty much the opposite of the messages our bodies will send to us when we feel under threat, which is the way we tend to feel when we're facing someone we perceive as our enemy. Also, if we try to make it happen, if we try to drum up those feelings, we're likely going to end up basically as the shredded stuffy in the garbage bin. It's not going to work, odds are. Equating love your enemies with just ratcheting up the niceness volume is both unworkable and inadequate. Now, don't tell me about this if it is the case, but I'm guessing that most of us know someone that, in the name of their religious beliefs, behaved niceness in overdrive in public, but was judgmental, maybe even vindictive and vicious in private. That's not what loving your enemies is about. Love, as anyone that has been or is in a long-term relationship that they want to characterize as loving, love is often a very sturdy act of the will. It's often not nice and warm and fuzzy and romantic at all. I do not envy the circumstances under which Jesus, who generated that, or is credited with generating that statement, love your enemies. I'm not envious of the circumstances under which Jesus and his fellow Jews lived at all. They were oppressed as a people group. They were overtaxed. They were underrepresented. They were religiously placated. They were violently put down if they stepped beyond the bounds of that placated allowance and tried to speak for themselves. They had, I would say, more in common with the black, indigenous, or other people of color or other marginalized groups of this century than with whoever the primary power holders of this century might be, despite Christian, air quotes, Christian religious behavior to the contrary in many instances. Which is partly why I feel like the genius of Jesus applies so well to this 21st century problem of polarization. When Jesus said, love your enemies, he was tapping an old, deep vein of wisdom. He was talking about taking a costly approach to conflict that keeps showing up not only in the wisdom literature of history, but in the contemporary peace-building strategies of our time, our best ideas about how we might build peace. He was talking about trying to find ways to move toward our enemies instead of throwing up more and more barriers between us and them. I want to show you guys a couple pictures. Facebook Live, as far as I could figure it out, is not really set up to do this nicely. I'm going to show you physical prints of them. I have also included a posted a link to our Facebook page this morning for the artist who made these particular sculptures, and so you can look up his site online. But more about who that is and all that in a moment. But let me just show you the images first. So I'll just do that television thing, but without the advantage of a designated camera for this, and hold these up so you can see them. That is as big as it looks. It's a huge, huge sculpture, huge art installation. There's also a black and white night photograph of this that I'm going to put up just because I like photographs. And this is a, whoop, there we go. This is a beauty. Graphically, it's just so strong. The artist is an Italian sculptor named Lorenzo Quinn. And Quinn put that particular installation up for the Venice Biennale in 2019. It's called Building Bridges. And the link that I put up is for Quinn's own website. This person's work, oh my word, do take a moment to go there. I mean, maybe this stuff doesn't speak to you at all, but then just take a moment. If it does, you might fall in there and stay for a while. He's got this one piece called Force of Nature 2 that just takes my breath away, like every time. Anyway, Lorenzo Quinn put this thing up for this biennale in 2019. For a reason. He says he wanted to symbolize how people can overcome their differences, how we can reach toward one another over whatever it is that divides us. And so these hands reaching toward one another over this channel, this canal, this waterway in Venice. There are six pairs of hands. A little hard to see that in the perspective that these photographs showed. There's lots of photographs in under just images if you search Lorenzo Quinn building bridges, including some aerial shots where you can see the shapes of the different hands a little better. But there are six pairs of hands, and each pair represent an essential value. So this is how Quinn describes it. These values represented by these different hands are friendship, to build on the future together, wisdom, to make mutually beneficial decisions, help, to cement lasting relationships, faith, to trust in your heart and self-worth, hope, to persevere in worthwhile endeavors, and love, the fundamental purpose of it all. Quinn's work is quite spiritually powerful in my experience, from my perspective, and well worth spending some time with. One of the reasons that Jesus would say something like love your enemies is because, as far as we can tell, Jesus believed that we are all children of Creator, all children of God, that we are all siblings. And whatever the current or the force or the power is that we call life or energy or God, we are all just dipping our toes in it. It's the kind of power that could just as well sweep us away as sustain us. A little bit goes a long ways. It's what we have in common. Or if you prefer the metaphor from last week, it's the sea that we're all swimming in. Pleasant enough for a cooling dip, but don't ignore the riptide. It's powerful. Jesus also seemed to believe that that means that at our core, we're made to love one another, even when it doesn't seem like the most logical thing to do. And goodness knows, there are many instances, large and small, and everything in between, where it does not seem like the logical thing to do. And that's why, when Jesus was asked to sum up his teachings, he chose love one another as his defining statement. He also chose to define God as love. Quinn's installation symbolizes a vision of what it might mean to put love into action. It means reaching towards someone on the other side of an apparent divide, and doing so in friendship, seeking the wisdom of mutually beneficial decisions, offering the sort of help that produces lasting relationships, having faith that the value we each carry as children of Creator makes us both worthy of offering those sorts of things and worthy of receiving them, and acting in hope and with the power of love. As Klein very practically suggests, that means working with other people, working with our siblings on real problems, or, as Jesus so succinctly put it, loving one another, because that's what that means. We can do this. We can do this, but it takes practice. And practice can be painful, painful incremental stuff. Taya needed to contribute a piano piece to her teacher's virtual piano Christmas celebration the other day. And so I was her in-house technician. And the piece we were recording was quite difficult. And it took more than one pass. And Taya, who has high standards for herself, was frustrated with her own performance, not ultimately satisfied with it at all. We chose the best take, but the A-type perfectionist in her, which she comes by through no fault of her own, never really settled that the job was done. And her comment was, "That's the level that I've been able to practice this to for now." She practices diligently enough to know that when we practice things, they change. And when we practice well, they get better. When we practice poorly, they don't. We get better if we practice the things that make us better. We get worse if we practice the things that make us worse. There's really something to that. And when it comes to loving people not like us, when it comes to reaching across divides, this is also true there, that this takes practice and that it is incremental, sometimes very mundane, often arduous, not very warm, cuddly, fuzzy, feel-goody. It's more about a sturdy act of the will. But it is something that we can do. We can practice it. And best, really, to start hyperlocal, I think, with these things. And to ask a question like, who can I reach toward today with something I might call friendship or wisdom or help or faith or hope or love? Who can I reach across a divide toward with one of those things today? And it might be, well, these days, it might need to be someone in the same house or within reach in some other way. Reach out, but do it safely. But let's try to think of a way before the end of the day to enact one of those, to reach across something we experience as a divide with one of those values: friendship, wisdom, help, faith, hope, or love. And then just take a simple step that moves us toward it, even if it feels really small. Thanks for listening to me explore some of those ideas on our behalf as a community, and I hope together with us as a community, it feels like a reach sometimes when we're not in the same space, but it's a hope that remains alive in me, very, very active in me. Peace to you all.